Now, this is the way God intended for me to operate and have some of these things that benefit me, not a lot of them, but some of them that benefit me, and how the, what he gives me to help me offset that. He intends for me to operate within this framework of the balanced life. Now, notice I put something out here. I got that over on the left side of the chart, because right here next to my balanced life is the lives of other people. Always going to be there. Maybe your spouse, maybe your children, maybe your neighbor, maybe your fellow workers, maybe people in traffic, maybe this kind of stuff. These are lives that are out here. Okay, what happens to you and I? Next chart. Once we take God out and put ourselves in the center of our life, selfishness and self-centeredness, we put self in there, we take our whole life, I take my whole life and I move it over to the right, this way. Instead of being over here where God intended for it to be, now it's way over here. Then what happens? Instead of reasonable resentment and self-resentment, I replay every situation. I become angry and hateful. I justify my position. Anybody identify with that? I end up sulking or having silent scorn. Go back to formaning. If I'm sitting up in front of my garage and my life is being operated this way with self in the center, and I look down there and he's getting out his paint, his ladders, and his brushes, I say, damn him. He's doing that just to make me look bad. On purpose.
Yeah, and you can't keep it in that one area.
No, you can't keep it within the paint of the house. Besides that, his automobile is newer than mine. And his grass is greener. And the reason it's greener is because he gets all his fertilizer for nothing, because he works for the fertilizer division of Georgia Pacific, and I got to pay $19.95 for a 25-pound bag of Scott's Turf Builder. You know, I'm sitting up there and I'm getting madder than the devil, and I haven't got any love and no patience and no tolerance, and I'm replaying the situation, and I'm justifying my position. And what happens pretty soon? His house is painted, looks good, his grass is green, his new car's operating fine. I'm sitting up there madder than a hornet, scared to death that somebody's going to drive in and say, golly, your house looks terrible in comparison to Romani's. See what happens with self-will? Same thing in the fear area. Instead of reasonable fears, they get out of limits. Those kind of fears, folks, that keep us awake at 2 o'clock in the morning, things that ain't ever going to happen and never do. Expectation, anxiety, fright, greed, procrastination. How many times does this jump up and get us? Put things off because we're scared of the results. God doesn't like that. That's selfish and self-centered. Courage and faith shrink up, not much of it. In the area of sex, and harm's done to it, it becomes selfish. It becomes a control thing. Gratification only. Inconsiderate of others. Overuse. With self in there, moving that thing out to the right. Very little wisdom and prudence and logic. You see what happens? Instead of being over here where God intended for me to be, now I'm over here. What's bad about that? What's over here? What's right here? Lives of other people. Remember? And I'm colliding with them. And I'm stepping on their toes. And they're retaliating. And I don't like that. And I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. Do you remember the emotional barometer in the disease concept chart? If that emotional barometer is here, where I'm operating under self-will, all of this out-of-limit stuff is going to drive that emotional barometer up. Now, if my goal is to keep that emotional barometer down where it belongs so that it's not necessary for me to take that one drink, then I better find a way to move this thing back over here where God intended for it to be. That's what recovery's all about, folks. If I understand that because of selfishness and self-centeredness, my life can't operate like this, but instead operates like this, and that my goal is to get it back as near to this as I can, then I'll understand that to make a beginning, I must be rid of this. Because there's no way for God to come in and do this if these things over here in excess are occupying my mind and taking 100% of the time I got to think.
Okay.
So Bill makes that point here. I think we have to make it very clear how important that is.
Do you know how an alcoholic would handle that deal with four Maney? He'd sit up there and he'd get so mad, he'd say, at midnight tomorrow night, I'm going over there and burning his house down. That's the easy way to do it. On page 62, first paragraph, he said, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past we have made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. I didn't think there were any must in you.
Mm-hmm. They took them all out except right here. They took all the musts out of here except they let Bill write the rest of this book, see? And he put them right back in because he felt that there was, remember I told you he felt inadequate to write this because he knew how important this part of the book was to deal with this idea of selfishness and self-centeredness and how important it was, how absolutely necessary it was for me to try to be rid of that. And so he uses a lot of musts here. And he says here, we must be rid of selfishness or it kills us.
He said, we must or it kills us. And then he makes a statement. He said, God makes this possible.
Not now.
You can underline that.
You can underline that. Next time you are in a group and somebody talks about the refrigerator or the telephone pole or whatever things we might hear in AA meetings about a power greater than ourselves, you run back and you get out page 62 and you read here and interject that in there. We must or it kills us. The telephone pole makes that possible. Or the... It doesn't look too good in my book there. You've heard some people say that, haven't you? Or is that too? Have they gone beyond that in suburban Atlanta?
He said, and there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid. Many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them even though we would have liked to. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help.
That's what he says again. I hope you underline that. He says we have to have God's help. It can't. That's not going to be the group entirely because they're made up of a bunch of human beings just like you and us. Great. We had to have God's help. Folks, we're not beating around the bush here. Neither is Bill. He's telling us what's absolutely necessary if I want to be rid of self-will.
He said this is the how and the why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God.
And
it didn't work.
He tells us that again.
He said, next, we decided that hereinafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director.
Told you he'd put that right back in there again. See, after they made him take it out over on a couple pages earlier.
He said, he is the principal, we are his agents. He is the father, we are his children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we passed to freedom.
Look at your life. Look at your arch chart again. Now he's talking about another stone that we put in the arch chart. And he tells us a little bit more about what we're building. This particular stone he talks about is the keystone. And we know that that's the stone up at the top. That's the stone that keeps the walls from collapsing in. The keystone. The keystone. The decision that we make in step three. And why is it important for the keystone to keep this thing from collapsing? Because now he refines it even more. Because he tells me or us that we're building an arch through which we can or will pass to freedom. Bill loves these words. He's going to continue to use them. We're not going to continue to use the chart. We'll use it for steps 4 and 5, and then we'll let you put your own blocks in place. But we want you to understand how we think this arch chart does show exactly what we're trying to do in recovery to build this new life, this arch through which we can pass to freedom.
I had a Mason one time tell me, he says, you know another significance to that arch? And I said, what's that? He said, as a Mason, all of this is built on a form. He says, to build an arch, you need the form. And he says, our program is the form. And he said, like any other arch, if we try to move the form before we get the arch completed, it'll collapse. And that's what happens to us when we don't do that. He said, when we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things happened. We had a new employer, being all-powerful. He provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we begin to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn.
Wow, that's pretty strong language. We were reborn. That sounds kind of evangelical or whatever, doesn't it? Churchy. That's pretty churchy right here in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Can you imagine the guts of putting that in there? But he says that at step 3. Once I buy into this idea of being rid of selfishness and self-centeredness, and I'm ready to, and I'm making that decision that I'm ready to move on with the inventory and the things that follow, then some of these things will begin to happen. If somebody asks you later on, you've been sober a couple of years, somebody asks you, you think you've had a spiritual awakening, go back to 63 and ask yourself these questions. Am I less and less interested in myself and my little plans and design, more and more interested in seeing what I can contribute to life? Ask yourself, do you feel new power? Have you enjoyed peace of mind? Do you discover you can face life successfully? Conscious of his presence? Lose the fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter? Certainly, you can say yes to some of those things, and let me tell you, you've begun to have a spiritual awakening that's necessary to recover from the disease of alcoholism already at step 3.
He said, we are now at step 3. Many of us said to our Maker as we understood him, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help, of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. We thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to him. We found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person such as our wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor. But it is better to meet God alone than with one who might misunderstand. The wording was, of course, quite optional. So long as we expressed the idea, voicing it without reservations, this was only a beginning, though if honestly and humbly made, an effect, sometimes a very great one, was felt at once. Now, the book says this, and sometimes this is true. But if you get to this point in your recovery program and nothing drastic doesn't happen, don't feel left out or anything. Because a lot of times nothing happens much at this area. And you know why? We haven't done anything yet. The only thing we've done is make a decision. Okay? And we've been talking for the last, 30 minutes on self-will and what self-will does to us. And I never understood that. But you know, back on the bottom of page 61, over there, Bill was talking about the actor. And I never really understood what he was talking about until we started studying this self-will that we've been going over for the last little while. You know, when I grew up, I had a little script. I wrote a little script for my life. I says, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do that, and I'm going to get married, and I'm going to have children, and I'm going to have this job, and I'm going to get this house. And as a result of this script that I wrote in my head, I knew that if everybody would just follow the script, then everybody would be supremely happy, including me. And when I got married the first time, You know, the go ahead and make comments, one. Dick. When I got married the first time.
I got to do this, you know, to get back at him. I don't have much to get back at him on because he keeps getting to me and telling me, you know, about how old I am and, you know, jokes with me in front of you folks. I have to have something to get him.
Well, that's right.
Wife number one.
When I first got married, I had this script for my wife to play. And, you know, there's a horrible thing about self-will. Everybody has it. And I discovered when we got married, lo and behold, she had her own script. And it didn't match my script. So what I would do is I would try to exert my script onto her, and it would make her unhappy and make her miserable, and she would retaliate and make my life miserable, and I just couldn't understand what was going on. Because I had scripts for everybody. I had scripts for her. I had scripts for my children. They were going to do this, this, and this. I had a script for the people I worked for. And occasionally, even the guy that ran the convenience store down at the corner. You know, I had one for him. And if they would just do all this, everything would be okay. But things didn't work out. And the more I tried to exert my script, the more she retaliated, the more miserable she got, the more it hurt my life, and the more miserable I became. So any life run on self-will can never, ever be a success. You're always in conflict with other people when you do this. Okay.
And my mind is always occupied, filled with these resentments, these fears, and the shame, guilt, and remorse that I'm doing, some harms I'm doing to other people. You understand that? Does everybody remember getting angry early in the morning and how that thing fills your mind all day long and you're not effective in anything else because that thing occupies your mind all day long. And let me tell you, I'm going to do some things on the inventory that'll show you what I'm talking about. We no way for me to carry out the decision in step three if my mind's occupied with all this other junk. So he's going to show me how to whittle that stuff away so that God can come in a little bit at a time and begin to take over. It's not a fast process, but a lot of progress is made right here because he said, this is only beginning, though if honestly and humbly made, an effect, sometimes a very great one, is felt at once. I may start to have that spiritual awakening even at this point when I understand how important it is to be rid of self-will.
Do we understand what self-will is, and we understand what self-will has been doing to us in the past? Is it a little bit clearer why we got into some of the difficulties that we did as practicing alcoholics? Okay. He said, bottom of the page, he said, next we launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us had never attempted. Though our decision,
that's step three,
was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us.
Step four.
Our liquor was but a symptom. We had to get down to causes and conditions.
Now, there's some things that might keep me from moving on into step four. This tells me that doesn't give me a vacation here after step three and step four. Moves right along from the paragraph on the bottom of page 63 right into next, we launched into a program, a course of vigorous actions. Now, there's some things that might keep me from doing that right away. Might be some sort of fear that I have of hearing about how complicated a four-step inventory is. Pride might say I don't need it. Fear might say I don't dare. Too complicated. If those things happen, I might not have taken an adequate step three. I might not have understood at the step three level how necessary it is to be rid of selfishness and self-centeredness. I'm never going to be able to make a beginning on that unless I'm able to approach step four. Really not that tough, this four step. We've made it kind of tough. We've come up with some inventory guides. Everybody knows about the Hazelden Inventory Guide, which is 8 or 10 or 12 pages long. We've heard about, there was one in Dallas, Texas, which was twice as long as the Hazelden Guide. And and we read about, we hear about telling all your life story. You know, people write for pages upon pages about what they started to do back when they first remembered and did those first things that they shouldn't have done, and all of those things, and when they went smoked their first cigarette and did all those things. And this case, these are things that we already know about. What I'm trying to disclose in this inventory is things that they're hidden and that I really don't know about, that I haven't thought about. When I was born, when I went to school, when I got married, when I was in the service, I know all these. I knew all this. It had nothing to do with my alcoholism. And there's no action to take on those. And probably they cover up the things that do have something to do with my alcoholism that I do need to take action on. Now, the big book outlines a way which is very simple to do that. And so we're going to start that on the page 64, and we're going to use the inventory method that Bill prescribes in the textbook Alcoholics Anonymous. We're not knocking the Hazelden Guide or the Dallas Guide or all your life story. We're just going to use the big book guide if you'll permit us to here. Whether you not want to use it in the future is up to you.
Absolutely. You do it any way you want to. But I'm going to tell you something. You know, the reason that people get away from the big book inventory guide is that it is so simple till it's hard for us alcoholics to complicate. And if we can't complicate things, then if it seems too easy, we just won't try. But I'm going to tell you something. If you take what the big book says and you add in the Hazelden inventory guide, you're going to be a little confused. If you get in what the book says and the Hazelden guide and the Dallas guide and mix them together, you're going to be a little bit more confused. If you're going to take those two guides and mix it in with the big book and add all your life story, you're going to be like a termite in a yo-yo. You're not going to know which way to go. So what we're going to do is we're just going to stay in this one little area the big book says.
They just figured out that termite and yo-yo. That's back when yo-yos were made out of wood, folks.
Oh, yes. This is before Duncan. I'm sorry. I'm dating myself. He said, therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four. And notice one thing that Dick and I neither one have mentioned. You want to do this? The time frame.
What?
The time frame.
Well, he says here, there's not many places that he gives us a time frame, but he does in the top of page 64 in that paragraph that we just finished. He says that it could have little permanent effect unless at once was followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us, the resentments, the fear. And that at once. He doesn't say take 6 months. He doesn't say, take a little break here, come in tough making this decision. He says, at once we move on into taking this inventory. Now he's going to do one of the same things that he does so well to make a point. He's going to tell a story. He's going to tell a story, and we're going to see it in your next handout, is the business versus personal inventory comparison.
Okay, he says, a business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke.
Now, he says, okay, the folks that are reading this book probably know what a business inventory is. So I'm going to start out by using the example of a business inventory, Bill says. Let's talk about something that they know something about to make a point about something they probably aren't totally familiar with. So he's going to talk about a business inventory.
He says, taking a commercial inventory is a...
Dadgum him. Just said business inventory, and now he's saying commercial. Why doesn't he use the same word? Because he does not like to use words that mean the same thing repetitious. He wants to use different words. No difference between a business and commercial inventory.
Is a fact-finding and fact-facing process. It is an effort to discover the truth about the stock in trade. One object is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods, to get rid of them promptly and without regret.
Now what he tells us here is that a business takes no personal inventory, goes broke. We know that. And we know that I use Family Dollar Store as an example because their headquarters are close to Matthews and you see them all over the place. But if Family Dollar Store it doesn't periodically inventory its stuff in its retail stores and in its warehouse, it's never going to know for sure what's there. And the inventory process that Family Dollar Store does is a fact finding, find out all the facts about what's around there in the warehouse and in the retail store, to face those facts, to see the truth about them, to disclose the things that are damaged and unsaleable, and to get rid of them promptly and without regret. And then he goes on to say,
he says, if the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about value.
Can't fool himself about any of these things. If the president, chief executive officer of Family Dollar Store gets the results of his business inventory, the facts, the what's there, how many of them are there, a truthful accounting of the stock in trade, can see what's damaged and unsaleable, can't fool himself about the results. He's got one choice and one choice only: to get rid of damaged and unsaleable goods, that's his object, promptly and without regret. He can't say to himself, I convinced the board 5 years ago that these women's purses were going to sell like hotcakes, and consequently we bought a million of them. And we still got 999,900 of them left. And I can't fool myself about this and said, I think next year these are going to sell like hotcakes. I got to get rid of them. They're unsaleable. And I can't have any regret over it. Even though I paid $10 a piece for them, I got to sell them for $2. Get rid of them. I got to give them away at yard sale. That means I must be rid of them. Okay, understand what a business inventory does, what its object is. Fact-finding, fact-facing, truthful accounting of what's out there.
Okay.
To disclose damaged and unsaleable goods and to get rid of them promptly and without regret, and he can't fool himself about values.
Okay, so then it's real long instructions here. He said, we did exactly the same thing with our lives.
Huh. We did exactly the same thing with our lives. Because he tells us we got to take a personal inventory. So let's look at what step four says. What does step four say? We made a
searching.
Fact finding. And?
Fearless.
Fact facing. Uh-oh. Yeah, we run into trouble with that word. Moral. Sounds to me like a list of dirty, nasty, filthy things, doesn't it? Well, that's not what it is at all. If he'd want to make a searching and fearless inventory of the dirty, nasty, filthy things, he'd have said immoral. Right? Well, he said moral. One of the definitions of moral is truthful. Not immoral or amoral, but truthful. So he tells me to make a searching and fearless, truthful inventory of who?
Ourselves.
Ourselves. Only stock and trade I got. And he tells me, I'll paraphrase, he tells me that my object is the same as the business inventory: to find the flawed thinking process that keeps God from running my mind, to find out what the resentments and the fears and the harms and the shame, guilt, and remorse that's occupying my life and the harm I'm doing to other people, find out where it is and what it's come from, to disclose damage and unsaleable good. And my other object is the same as the business. What is it? To get rid of them promptly and without regret. Why? So that God can gradually come in and begin to direct my life again. Can't direct it with all these things in there. That uses that to explain what the personal inventory is. I hope you understand it. Should be very clear.
Okay. And what we're doing is we're trying to get ourselves in position so we can carry through with the decision that we made in chapter 3. He said, chapter 5. We took stock honestly. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup, which caused our failure. Being convinced that self, manifested in various ways, was what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestation. He said, resentment is the number one offender.
And self-resentment.
It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease, for we have not only been mentally and physically sick, we have been spiritually sick.
Look what he says now. I always thought that if I could quit drinking and get better, feeling better physically, then when I felt better physically, I could deal with the way I thought and felt, my emotions. And once I got better physically and emotionally, then I could begin to look at some spiritual changes. Not what he says here. What does he say?
He said, when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically.
Golly, dadgum him, he got it reversed, see? He says that once I deal with the spiritual malady and get it working in the right direction, then I straighten out mentally and physically. So I had to trash my original idea, and I had to go along with Bill's.
Okay, now we're going to talk about resentments for a little while, and Bill says here that they are the number one offender.
We're going to get you out of here a little early if you let us do two inventories, the resentment and the fear inventory, and we'll stop there because Jerry, at an advanced age, does better with sex in the morning when he's rested than late in the afternoon.
Wishful thinking. I'll tell you this on myself. Chris was telling us that they might have had a vice raid over at the hotel where we're staying. And somebody snickered and said, boy, you better be glad you didn't get caught up in that raid. And I told them, I said, I'd give them my extra $100 if they could prove I was guilty. Okay. We can do it a couple of these, but we need to talk about what a resentment is. If we're gonna talk about resentments, we need to figure out what one of these dudes is. Now, what is a resentment, Dick?
Resentment comes from the word, the Latin word sentir, S-E-N-T-I-R-E. Sentir means feel. And so resentment means re-feel. Does that make sense? And so we're going to look at this, the definition of resentment as re-feeling, replaying things, replaying events, replaying people. That's what a resentment is. Now it begins to make sense, because we're good at that. We invented the instant replay machine that the NFL uses long, long before the NFL thought about it. We invented that replay machine. You know what the instant replay machine does in the NFL. You watch a play, and you see the quarterback get sacked, and it looks kind of rough. But then they rewind it, and they play it slower. And you notice that his legs buckle under him when he's getting sacked, and it looks worse. And then they zoom in on it a little bit. And finally, they zoom in and slow it down enough so you can see the sweat pop off his brow when he gets hit, and his mouthpiece pops out, and the chin strap pops off his helmet. And it looks terrible.
And this guy's back out there playing football, you know, and they keep replaying this thing.
We do the same thing with our resentment machine. We turn it on in the morning and we pan it on our day's life. And it records what people are doing to us. And then at night, we rewind it and we replay it and we look at it again. And then we rewind it and we slow it down. And we look at it slower, see what they're doing or done. We zoom in a little bit. And boy, we can see how badly the world and the people of it has been treating us all day long.
And this resentment machine is like the 6 o'clock news. It only gets the bad stuff. It won't record any good stuff at all.
Just bad stuff. So you see what resentment is? Replay, refeel. And we got a switch on our machine that nobody else has. And there's some days when nobody does anything to us. Now, if you're an alcoholic, that's a bad day. So we got a switch where we can turn it on that tells us what they're thinking.
And there's another little attachment that comes with this machine that's called a get-even machine. You know, you play this over, and then you mash a little button on this attachment and say, and the next time they do that, this is what I'm going to do. They're not going to treat me that way. You know, and I'll tell you what happens to us. We wind up in these resentments, and I don't know about you, but I am totally paralyzed when I get a good resentment working in my mind. And it is a shortcut way of living. It is a way for us to reassign blame. You know, a resentment is a lie. It doesn't start out to be a lie, and we don't intend for it to be a lie. But you know, every time we replay this in our mind, guess what happens? they get just a little bit worse, and we get just a little bit better. And if you let me replay that thing enough, I'm going to be sitting there minding my own business, pure as the driven snow, and they did all this stuff to me. And it's a way that we can place blame, and we can go through life and not have to look at ourselves and reassess our situation and do anything about us, which is the major problem. Okay, it allows us, it's a shortcut way of living. It's almost like, you know, our body has mechanisms built into it, like we have built resentments into it. One of them is, if any of you ever gone and bought a pair of shoes, and one of them have a little place in it, be a little small or something, and it would irritate your foot. Well, your body understands and realizes what you've done. And as a result, it starts developing a callus in order to protect your foot from the shoe. And it does a pretty good job of it. But then if you're not careful and you don't watch out, the callus itself will become a continuing problem. And that's what we do with resentments. You know, it's just like the story of my whole life till I got to AA. None of my character defects, I didn't start out to be a SOB. All of my character defects were originally solutions to something. You know, and then the solution became the problem. And that's the same way with resentments. We use resentment as a solution to not having to look at ourselves, and then the solution itself becomes a problem. And it will devastate us unless we do something about it.
In dealing.
Yeah, he says, in dealing, I don't know much about the English language. Now, Bill was a little more educated than me, but I know two things. Period means stop, and comma means pause. So, he says here, now, this is real complicated. I want you to follow along with me as best you can. In dealing with resentments, comma, we set them on paper, period.
Now that does away with the head inventory, doesn't it? That does away with me sitting around running back through my life in my head, because Bill says we put them on paper. Okay, now we're going to use these forms that you got in your handout. Let me suggest this, that don't mark them up, because you're going to want to use them later on. You're going to have to make some copies. If you're going to take your own inventory, make 15 of resentment, 10 of fears, 5 of sex, 5 of harm done to others. 5 of harms on others outside the sex area, and keep a master copy around, because people you sponsor are going to want to use them, and you're going to have to make copies. A lot of folks call me. I got spares, but no reason why you can't keep some here yourself. We're going to look at the resentment form. It's the same form that's in the big book. So let's look at what Bill says. We're going to work the columns top to bottom. Let's see what Bill says for us to do.
Okay. Now, after he's done told us, he gave us one instruction. He said, in dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. Now we got our paper out. This is what we do. He said, we listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry.
Okay.
Period.
First one I put down was Barbara. That's my wife of almost 49 years. And I put her down again because I got a couple. I put a guy by the name of Mr. X down because it makes good inventory discussion. I put web tax down. I'm retired for a long time, but I do taxes for a local Charlotte tax firm in the springtime. And I put the U.S. economy down just for the heck of it, okay? Just to list something, because what it says is we listed people, institutions, and principles with whom we were angry.
Now, if you're wondering what principles can be, the Ten Commandments are a few, you know, if you don't like them. There are some others. You know, my dad used to tell me all the time, said, son, you sleep with the dogs, you're going to get fleas on you every time. I hated that. But I got a lot of fleas.
Now he says,
we ask ourselves why we were angry, period.
Period. Stop. Work column two, top to bottom. The first thing I put down is the beach trip. The one I told you about the 8 tablespoons of rum. Everybody, my 2 daughters, my 2 son-in-laws, with whom I'm well pleased, my 6 grandchildren and me, we have a ball at the beach. We have a good time for a week. They do things. I don't put any restrictions on them at all. They love it. Barbara has a terrible time at the beach. Because Barbara likes everything neat and put together. And if you've ever been to the beach, you know that there's never that there's always going to be sand, that there'll never be a partially consumed can of pop. I mean a fully consumed can of pop. Always either unopened or partially consumed sitting somewhere out in the open. There's never a matching flip-flop or bathing suit part anywhere together. Towels and wet bathing suits never get hung up. A door never gets fully closed about this far. And Barbara positions herself right in the best spot in that big old place that I rent so that she can see the most. She can see the back, the front, the decks, upstairs in her loft, all, two of the three bathrooms, and she has a miserable time. So because of that, I kind of have a miserable time. Another thing that I put down for resentments is her new automobile, her automobiles, period, and her Precious Moments Collectibles convention. She has a huge Precious Moments Collectibles, serious collector.
Serious collector. Serious collector. Precious Moments.
I think now the count is 1,750, 1,800, something like that. I can't remember. Anyway, it's a serious collection, okay?
1,400, 5 years ago. So.
Mr. X. 1,600.
Now you have to understand that my friend Dick here is I think financial insecurity and him were actually twins.
Now I put Webtax down. They're who I work for. I had a little medication change 2 weeks into the tax season. I had a gal that I had trained for 1 week to be the number two person office to kind of back me up and be there at daytimes and everything like that, and I got my cardiologist said he wanted me to go in the heart unit for a week, and so I called the Web and I told them that, and they said go now, don't wait until it gets heavy, and we'll take care of covering for you for the new gal. We'll take care of that. And so I went to the hospital and I was there from Monday to Friday, and I kept checking with her and I could see things weren't going too well, and so I got back there on Monday, and I had her letter of resignation where she'd given up and quit. So I was kind of angry at the way they handled that. The $1,600, Mr. X, he was a guy sponsored in AA. He got access because of something I did to help him out to my checking account debit card number. And before I could get it cut up and stopped, he got to it for $1,600. And, you know, that bothered me. Economy, the reason is that my IRAs and 401K going south, okay? All right, not anymore, but they were, and it was a valid resentment category. See what we've done here? We've listed the persons and the principals and the institutions with whom we were angry. Make your own, folks. Let me tell you, you think I'm kidding when I say make 15 copies of the resentment inventory. I am not kidding. I do a lot of inventory with guys that I sponsor, and it's not a rare thing when they have 10, 12, 15 pages of resentments. Now, you don't think you got that many. Well, once you start doing this, you'll find out what you got. Okay, and these are the reasons. Next, we do the causes. Now it says,
in most cases, it was found that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambitions, and our personal relationships, including sex, were hurt or threatened. So we were sore. We were burned up. On our grudge list, we set opposite each name our injuries. Was it our self-esteem, our security, our ambitions, our personal or sex relations, which had been interfered with?
I remember the natural instinct list that we already went over. Now, I'm not going to be angry with you if you don't threaten one of those instincts. But the reason I'm angry, or the reason of the cause that I'm angry, is because you threaten one of these instincts. Remember what they are. Social, material, and emotional security, and the sex instinct. So let's look at Barbara. Now, remember, one other thing happens here when I do column two. You know, I always thought it was her or them. I always kind of personalized this resentment and anger. But if I asked myself the question, if anybody else did column two to me, would I be just as angry? And the answer is yes. So it kind of begins right off the bat and to depersonalize the thing. And I find out it's really not who or they did, but what they did. Now I'm going to find out even more about it because I'm going to look at what natural instinct is threatened, okay? Emotional security is threatened by Barber's Beach thing. I'll put an ES down there, emotional security, because she disrupts the family harmony and things which I think I'm supposed to be in charge of. I'm the patriarch. and the probably the social instinct. The automobiles and the precious moments collection, the material security. Can't spell security, material security. Mr. X and his $1,600, material security. Web tax. My emotional security. I mean, it's been emotional with a couple of days a week, and I haven't had anybody there to back me up. And when, especially during heavy season when I'm doing 18 to 20 returns a day. Emotional security.
Your social instinct.
Huh?
You put your social instinct on that too.
Yeah.
You know, when they don't treat your employees right, you feel bad about that too.
That's right. And the economy, my material security, my social instinct, my emotional security, because of the effect that I think it might have on my relationship with the family. You know, I want to be certain things to them and do certain things for them. So this gives you an idea of what I look for in column 3. If you don't threaten one of these natural instincts, I'm not going to be angry at you. And I begin especially to see in column 3 what natural instincts I have that are particularly sensitive and thin-skinned. What do you see repeating itself here over and over again? Material security. You see, and I know that that instinct is very thin, very, very out there to be manipulated, to be harmed, hurt. And I know that that's the area that I have to keep working on, and I do work on it. Jerry keeps me working on it, some other guys that keep me working on it, and I've made some progress on it, but I am not, I'm going to tell you, Barbara got another new car a week ago Saturday, or 2 weeks ago today, and I hope there are new car dealers in here, but if there are, I'm sorry. I never come away from Arnold Palmer Cadillac, jumping and shouting with joy that I got a great deal. For some reason, I never do that. I never think that, boy, did I ever get a great deal. And so it's that material security instinct again of Mr. X and his $1,600 material security. Web tax. See, I see a pattern here. I see where I'm very sensitive in an area that I have to work on and be very cautious about in the future. Now it says in column 4, we ask ourselves, and we're going to find out what this says a little later on.
He said, we went back through our lives. Now, we are going back through our lives, but let me tell you something. This is a current inventory. It is not a 20-year-ago inventory, or it's not a 5-year-in-the-future inventory. It is a current inventory. Like when you start putting down resentments, you can put down the resentments that you have in your mind today. Now, some of them may have been in there for 20 years. Some of them may have been for 15 years. But if they're still there, it's a today's inventory. Because what you had 20 years ago is not going to make you go broke unless you still got it. And what you intend to get in the future is not going to bother you. So it's a today's current type inventory. He said, we went back through our lives, nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty.
Down at the bottom of 65.
He said, when we were finished, we considered it carefully. The first thing apparent was that this world and its people were often quite wrong. To conclude that others was wrong was as far as most of us ever got. The usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Sometimes it was remorse, and then we were sore ourselves. But the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. As in war, the victor only seemed to win. Our moments of triumph were short-lived. It is plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. To the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile?
Now, he tells us something here that I know we can all agree on, that to the precise extent that I permit resentments and anger to occupy my mind, do I squander mental time that might be used more usefully? And I know that because I've done it. I've done it all day long when I've not been able to devote any of it to any useful purpose.
And you know, when I get caught up in a resentment, I have spent literally thousands of hours doing that. And to my knowledge, I have never made 5 cents worth of money. I have never improved a relationship. I have never solved any problem by doing that. Those are just totally wasted out. He said, but with the alcoholic, whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. We found that it is fatal. For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the Spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns and we drink again. And with us, to drink is to die.
Pretty high stakes, folks, that we're talking about here. He tells us how important this is. He says that if I harbor these things, it cuts me off from the sunlight of the Spirit, that the insanity will return, and I will not be able to see the truth through that drink when it's necessary for me to see the truth. And I drink, and for me to drink is to die. Big stakes. Doesn't happen to folks out there in rank-and-file society. And they do some, when they carry these resentments around, they do some other things, but they don't die, usually. But we die.
He said if we were to live, we had to be free of anger.
Had to be free of it. And he tells us this over and over. Bill makes a point over and over again. He will in this step study, or in this big book study, he does in the 12 step. He tells us that that anger is a luxury, dubious luxury of more balanced people. He says, we cannot afford under any circumstances anger. You know that as well as I do. I heard a gal say one night in Mint Hill Group a long time ago, my therapist says, that's all a little nervous, my therapist says that anger is good for me. Well, God bless her. Anger ain't good for me, folks. It never has been. I've never come off of the back of a period of anger when I felt that I was better off than I was before, or better off. So not good for me. Bill says that here. Justified or unjustified, and I'll tell you this, all anger for alcoholics is justified. You cannot admit that the anger you got is unjustified, just not in the alcoholic personality. All of it's justified.
He said, the grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. They may be the devious luxury of normal men, but for the alcoholic, these things are poison. He said, we turned back to the list, for it held the key to the future.
Well, not only am I going to find out on my resentment list what's blocking me off from God, but the key to the future. The key to the future. We'll talk about that in a minute. This is an important process, the inventory process.
From an entirely different angle, we begin to see that the world and its people really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, had power to actually kill. How could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We could not wish them away any more than alcohol. This was our course.
He tells us exactly what to continue to do. He's told us how to do part of the inventory. He's going to tell us how to finish it off now. He tells us about prayer.
He said, we realized that these people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Though we did not like their symptoms and the way these disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. We asked God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience we would cheerfully grant a sick friend.
Tough, isn't it, folks? That's tough. Bad. Hard to take instructions there.
When a person offended, we said to ourselves, this is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God save me from being angry. Thy will be done. Now, back in the back of the book on page 551, and I believe it's the same in both third and four, three in volumes three and four, printings three and four. This lady in a thing called Freedom from Bondage, let's look and see what she has to say about this God saved me from being angry.
Page 560, the middle, almost right a little bit past the middle of the page, the paragraph that starts, I've had.
Yeah, it's on 551, he said.
I'm sorry, 551 if you got the third and fourth edition.
I've had many spiritual experiences since I've been in the program, but many of them I didn't recognize right away, for I'm slow to learn and they take many guises. But one was so outstanding that I had to pass it on. Whenever I can, in the hope that it will help someone else as it has me. As I said earlier, self-pity and resentment were my constant companions, and my inventory began to look like a 33-year diary, for I seemed to have a resentment against everybody I had ever known. All but one responded to the treatment suggested in the steps immediately, but this one posed a problem. It was against my mother. It was 25 years old. I had fed it, fanned it, and nurtured it as one might a delicate child, and it had become as much a part of me as my breathing.
It had provided me with excuses for my lack of education, my marital failures, personal failures, inadequacy, and of course my alcoholism. And though I really thought that I would have been willing to part with it, now I knew I was reluctant to let it go. One morning, however, I realized I had to get rid of it, for my reprieve was running out, and if I didn't get rid of it, I was going to get drunk. And I didn't want to get drunk anymore. In my prayers that morning, I asked God to point out to me some way to be free of this resentment. During the day, a friend of mine brought me some magazines to take to a hospital group I was interested in, and I looked through them, and a banner across the front of one featured an article by a prominent clergyman in which I caught the word resentment. He said, in effect, if you have a resentment you want to be free of, if you will pray for the person or the thing that you resent, you will be free. If you will ask in prayer for everything you want for yourself to be given to them, you will be free. Ask for their health, their prosperity, their happiness, and you will be free. Even when you don't really want it for them, and your prayers are only words, and you don't mean it, go ahead and do it anyway. Do it every day for 2 weeks.
Wow. Every day for 2 weeks.
And you will find you have come to mean it and to want it for them, and you will realize that where you used to feel bitterness, resentment, and hatred, you now feel compassionate, understanding, and love. It worked for me then, and it's worked for me many times since, and it will work for me every time I'm willing to work it. Now, boy, it sounds like we may have to really pray for some of these people.
That's a tough instruction in freedom from bondage for us if we got a resentment.
Yes, it is. He said we, in the next paragraph on page 67, it says, we avoid retaliation or argument. We wouldn't treat sick people that way. If we do, we destroy our chances of being helpful. We cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. Then he says, referring to our list again.
Look at column 4. Putting out of our minds
the wrong others have done, we resolutely look for our own mistakes.
Okay, what did I do that set the things in motion in each one of these cases? What did I do that set the things in motion on the beach trip? Well, I'm going to tell you that 15 years ago or 16, when I decided to take my family to the beach every year, I didn't consult Barbara about it. I didn't ask to get her okay for it. I went ahead and made the arrangements. I whipped by Sunset Beach on my business trip one time, got a brochure, set the thing up myself. I realized that if I'd involved her in it and got her okay in it to begin with, been her idea and mine, that probably would have worked out better. So no involvement from the beginning, okay? New collection, new car, precious moments. Look, for a long time I understand that I deprived my wife of security. Times when I was not dependable, times when alcoholism had me in its grip and she was responsible to take care of two little girls and fend for herself and I wasn't responsible. And now I know that some things give her security and that may be the reason. So my past behavior may give that reason. Mr. X, what did I do? Dumb.
Don't laugh, he's serious.
I'm serious about that. I went, I finally had to tell Barbara about it. You know, the amount of money involved, I couldn't hide it, so I finally had to tell Barbara about it, and guess what she said? I'm dumb. And so I didn't give up there. I went up to the local charter bank, whatever the bank was at that time, First Charter, and I saw the branch manager who I knew up there, and I said to her, look, I think the bank is kind of responsible for some of this because you let it go on. And she looked at the thing, and guess what she concluded? Dumb. So she says you could call First Charter's headquarters in Concord and see what they say. Tell them your story. So I did. Dumb. Call them dumb.
You know, and anybody in their right mind would have let it go here. But not Dick. Not when you are eat completely up with financial insecurity like Dick is. And he's facing the $1,600 loss. He goes back to the motel where all this transpired.
It started at the motel when I put this guy up for a few nights. So I went down there, and I saw the motel manager.
And the motel manager at this particular motel that he housed this gentleman is an Indian. I don't mean a bow and arrow type Indian. I'm talking about with a turban and a ruby in his forehead type Indian. And he knew two words in English. Dick's dumb.
That's right. I love it.
And he, that was the end of that. Finally, I'll tell you what, his financial insecurity bothers him so much that, three or four years ago? How long?
What story are you telling?
I'm telling the one about, he has, when he writes checks out of his checkbook, he has a tooled leather checkbook cover that was given him by this guy. And across the front of that checkbook cover, it says, "Financial insecurity is alive and well."
Okay, what did I do? I look in column four to see my involvement in it, and I've covered it pretty well in the first three. And in the web tax situation and the economy, what have I done? I've done nothing. Didn't contribute to that. I couldn't control the fact that I had to be out of the office for 5 days. I couldn't control the fact that the hierarchy of web tax said that they'd cover it for me and didn't. So I didn't do anything. What'd I do about the economy? Nothing. And now it says... Where had we been?
Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened?
And we look for four things that we continue to look for in all of them. They're listed here. They got one that's not in the book. But where had I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened, and inconsiderate? And I look at each one of these, and I try to see where I'd been selfish. Didn't involve Barbara and a beach trip? Selfish. Inconsiderate, dishonest. Okay, just those three.
You were self-seeking too.
Huh?
You were self-seeking too because
Self-seeking. I wanted to do it myself.
You wanted a family.
The past behavior that might have set up the insecurity now, the same thing: selfish, inconsiderate, dishonest. Maybe not self-seeking, but Mr. X, selfish. Self-centered, wanted to, that pride, you know, yeah, I can help you out, James, with this, whip out my card, take care of a few days over here at the Masters Host Inn. Amazing, inconsiderate of Barbara, because, it's our money, it's not mine. You see what I can find out here? Web tax. I didn't do anything. I'm in trouble in column five now. So now I've got to ask myself, why am I holding on to it? If I didn't do anything, why am I holding on to resentment? Huh? Am I being honest? No, just not. Am I being self-seeking and frightened? Probably. Am I being inconsiderate of myself by holding on to it? Yeah, probably. Let's look at it that way. I have to ask myself why I'm holding on to it. Same thing with the economy. I look where I've been selfish and self-seeking, and inconsiderate of myself, certainly, because I'm holding on to that resentment when I did nothing to contribute. I got nothing to correct. I have to ask myself why I'm holding on to it.
Now, we hear this a lot from people in AA, and especially from some ladies, where things happened to you early in your life that you absolutely had nothing to do with. I mean, it happened, and that was the end of it. I mean, you had no contribution made to it. It's just that something happened to you, and that was it. Okay, well, that's over and done with. That is set in stone, and there is absolutely nothing that you can do to change that. But once you get to this part of the inventory, you need to make a determination. If you have these resentments and you did nothing to contribute to them, why are you still hanging on to them? You know, if you need to read the book in the back where that lady talked about her mother, where she used that resentment as an excuse for all of her failures and all of her shortcomings and all of this stuff. And if you get into areas like this in this last column, you may have to say that I'm dishonest because I'm using this resentment because I didn't do the things that I should have done. You know, I should have gotten an education anyway, even though this happened. And if we find out we're using them, even if we have no cause in it, and we see for a fact what these resentments do to us, then it will behoove us to do the things necessary to be rid of them. And we can do that through the program if we really work at it. One more thing before we get off of this. Dick is fixing to tell you some more stuff about this, but I want to say one thing. You know, when we look at a resentment, like Dick looked over there and he said, "I'm resentful at Barbara." That's the first thing that comes to our mind. You know, and that's normal. And we think this thing started in column one. And then we got to say, well, and column 2, and then we go to column 3 and 4 and 5. But you know, once we get to analyzing this, and the book says we need to list and analyze. You know, this started over here in column 5. This resentment with Barbara over the beach trip did not initiate in column 1. It initiated in column 5, which caused Dick to do the things that he did in column 4, which aggravated Barbara in column 1, and she retaliated in column 5. And column 2. So, where did that come from? Yes.
Thank you, whoever did that. Got a question up here in the front row.
Like greed and expectations.
Yeah. Sure. Unrealistic expectations, whatever you wanted to put in there, but they can all be in there. But you see, unless we work on these things that are listed in column 5, these people in column 1 are interchangeable. You know, as long as you're self-seeking and frightened and inconsiderate, and you have relationships with people, then you can change Barbara for Gladys and Gladys for Gwendolyn and so on down the line. You know, because those people over here are interchangeable. The way to have some resolution to this situation is to work over here in this fifth column, because that's where all of this stuff originates, most of it. Now, there will be some, like we've just talked about, that do not originate in column 5, but by and large, they will.
It's just to show you how strong that is about, especially ladies who have some things done to them when they were younger, which they had no control over. We did one in Decatur in July, and we're going to do another one in Decatur in July, like this. And two ladies came up to us during the break after this particular session. One had been sober 17 years, still harboring anger about things. Another lady had been sober only 3 months. A gal had been sober only 3 months, dealing with that. And how important that was for us to discuss that. So when you've got nothing in column 4, you have to deal with the column 5. Why am I holding on to that? Why am I letting it run my life? Very important. Now, it says that in resentment inventory, it holds the key to the future. And all the inventories hold the key to the future. Not only do I find out where I need to be less selfish, less inconsiderate, less self-seeking and frightened, less dishonest, less inconsiderate, when I need to stop doing the things that I've been doing, stop being so sensitive in these areas so that I cannot be resentful anymore, and I can remove some of that resentment so God can come in there and work, and I can carry out the decision in step 3. But the key to the future is in this too. Because I got some names and things in columns 1 and 2 and 3 that I can use in step 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. In column 3, I can use it in 5, 6, 7, and 10. In column 4, I can use it in 5, 6, 7, and 10. And in column 5, I can use it in 5, 6, 7, and 10. So in here holds the key to the future. These are things which I take into my fifth step inventory to sit down with another human being. These are the things that I need to look at every day to make sure they don't creep back in, because they're most likely to creep back in because they've been a key thing in the past. And so this is a very important process. If I go through the resentment inventory thoroughly, then I can be assured that I may be able to be resentment-free. And if I'm resentment-free, then I've freed up one-third of my mind that was previously occupied by resentments, and now God's got a chance to come in there, and I can carry out the decision that I've just made in step 3. Now, starting in the morning, we're going to go to very quickly through the fear and the sex and the harms done to other outside of the area of sex inventory, because they generally follow the same pattern as this. Once we understand how important it is to follow the instructions here, I don't know. I'm not an expert at that equipment. I'm not an expert even at this. But
X is unknown and spurt is a drip under pressure.
How am I doing now, Charlie? What's it coming? How's it going? Can you hear me now? Where are you? Am I getting out over the PA system, any? Can you hear me back there in the back? Well, we finished. Where was I? We finished the resentment inventory last night, the last thing. We finished the resentment inventory, and we hope that you'll go back. You'll remember what we covered in the resentment inventory, and all of the information that we got out of the resentment inventory is very detailed. And we certainly hope that we've set a pattern for taking the inventory. We won't have to go back over that pattern again with you. In the resentment inventory, not only do I have the capability of finding out why I was restless, irritable, and discontent, why I had those resentments in my mind that were occupying my mind, but I also found ways to get rid of them. And we think that you can be resentment-free through the inventory process. And if I'm successful in being resentment-free, with the exception of a few small things like NFL football players who do a dance in the end zone after they score a touchdown, a few things like that that may bother me, we can be resentment-free. And if I can do that, I can free up one-third of my mind so that I can carry out the decision that I've made in step three, and God can come in and He can work in that one-third of my mind. And now we move on page 67 with Jerry reading down at the bottom of the page. We move into another category of the inventory.
You know, our basic defects are the resentments and the fears and the guilt, shame, and remorse from the harms that we do other people. And we're going into the second area of that this morning. By the way, I'm still Jerry Tomlin. I have not changed much. I might have gained 3 pounds because I ate all those rolls last night at an Italian restaurant that were really good. But we're going into the fear area. And Bill says when he wrote the big book, he said resentment is the number one offender. But some 12 or 13 years later, when he wrote the 12 and 12 and had a lot more experience, and he had dealt with a lot more alcoholics, he says that self-centered fear is the activator of all of my defects. And I have found that in my case to be true. You know, this self-centered fear, and this fear normally manifests itself in one or two or three ways. We are afraid we're not going to get something we want. We're afraid that we're going to lose something that we've already got. Or we are absolutely petrified because we have done some things to people, and if they find out about them, they're going to retaliate, and we're going to be in a world of hurt. So this fear, shame, and guilt, and remorse. So Bill says down here, he says, notice the word fear is bracketed along the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Ms. Jones, the employer, and the wife. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our life. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstance which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. Now, what we're talking about here is not the good kind of fear. You know, fear is a natural instinct. And like Dick says yesterday, it keeps us from running out in front of cars and walking off of tall buildings and things like that. We're talking about unreasonable fear. You know, probably people they're a little bit afraid of the dark. And that's probably a healthy fear. Because you can't see at night. We don't have headlights like a car, you know, and it just breeds caution. But if your fear of the dark would exceed the bounds that God intended for it to be, and it got to the point where you could no longer even go out at night, then probably that fear would need to be addressed. It would have exceeded the bounds that God intended for it to be. But what we're going to talk about today is not the fear that brings caution, which is a natural instinct. We're going to talk about the unreasonable fears. So we reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper, period.
Okay, he tells us here, I'm not getting a red light, Charlie, when I flick it on, so you may need to change the battery. What he talks about here, he says we set them on paper. So again, Bill negates the idea that there's any such thing as a head inventory. It's a written inventory. So he tells us we set them on paper. And I've already done these, and this morning, as a matter of fact, I put these down, and I'm going to go through them quite quickly so that you can follow along at what I've done in the fear inventory, because this is an actual fear inventory of me that I've done as a kind of a help to you who may have to do it. Now, I remember one thing. Somebody asked me last night if we had any extra forms, the inventory forms, and I don't have any extras with me, but Chris up there has an extra copy, some extra copies of the handouts that have the forms in them, and he might send you those for whatever it costs him down at wherever he gets his copies made to... So you could have an extra copy of the forms. Like I told you, keep copies of these because you're going to want to use them. And the only way to get them, of course, is not to have them marked up. But he says we put them on paper, so it's got to be a written inventory. Then it says...
He said we put them on paper even though we had no resentment in connection with them. We ask ourselves why we had them.
Okay, we list the fears and... Give me a replacement, Charles. We list the fears, and I put down some here in the left-hand column. Guess who I start off with?
Barbara. Hey, Mom's afraid of Barbara.
I start off with Barbara, and then I put under the house here in the crawl space I got under my house. Got a fear of that. I put the general discharge that I got from the United States Air Force there because I was... dealing with fear when I was considering having that change or trying to have that change. I'm fear of my own personal health because I want to stay healthy. I have some fear of the economy as we used in the resentment inventory last night. So I've listed those fears and I put them down on paper. These are real fears for me or have been in the past. And then in column two, we ask ourselves...
Why we had them.
Why am I fearful of Barbara? Well, Barbara might, because of conditions or circumstances, she might leave. Am I coming across yet? she might leave me. That's why I'm fearful of Barbara. Sounds like I'm coming across. Thank you, Charlie. Why am I scared of under the house? I got some things I need to do under there. It's a pretty good sized crawl space The reason I'm scared about under the house was I went under there one day and there was a black snake under there. And I don't mind black snakes. They're pretty harmless. I prefer them better when they're out in the woods than I do when I'm under the house with them, quite frankly. And so I needed to do some work under there, but I had some fear about going under there. Why did I fear having the general discharge changed in my military? Discharge change, because it might turn me down. I might get turned down. Alcoholics don't like to be turned down, don't like to be shunned.